The Lord is my banner. When you think about a banner, we often think of a flag. And that's similar to what this word is about. But it's not entirely that case. But every 4 years or so, even every 2 years, but especially every 4 years or so, you have people who will start to campaign for one particular political person. And in their yard, you may drive by and you'll see a sign, "Vote for." And that sign, that banner, if you will, lets you know that they want you to rally behind that particular person. But it's not just that particular person, but the things in which that person has said that they will do, the things that person stands for, so forth and so on. When people are picketing out in front of a business, and they have, "We demand whatever it is, higher wages, more vacation days, whatever it is," you know that that's what they stand for, and they want you to rally behind that cause and to support them in that. And that is the idea that's made behind this particular word. But as we were singing about a moment ago, and as we're going to study about this morning, God is letting you know that He is your rallying point. That when you have those things in your life that are difficult, when you have something that you're fighting against, when you're in the midst of a battle and you feel overwhelmed, there is somebody that you can go to who is saying, "Rally behind me and I will help you. Rally behind me and I will actually do the fighting for you. Rally behind me and this is what I will do." That's who our God is. And this word that is used for Him, this name that is used for Him, reveals that part of His character. And so that is a name that we can go to in the midst of whatever struggle that we might be having. And so in Exodus 17 and verse 15, we're going to talk about the Amalekites for just a moment. Exodus chapter 17 and verse 15. The occasion for this writing in Exodus chapter 17, just to kind of give you a brief history. Remember that the children of Israel have come out of Egyptian bondage. They've crossed over the Red Sea. And they come and they're thirsty and God has provided for them, and then they're thirsty again. And now they come to this place where the incident with the rock is there. And if you have it at the very beginning of Exodus chapter 17, you see all the congregation of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. So they cry out to Moses, "Give us water to drink." So it says that Moses in verse 4 cried out to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people?" Verse 5, God tells Moses, "Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders. Also take the rod in your hand, which you struck the river." In verse 6, "I will stand before you there on the rock, and you will strike the rock and the water will come out." And you know that the name of the place was called Massah or Meribah in verse 7, because that's where they tempted the Lord. But they had a much bigger problem at this time in their life than just this water, because it also says at the end of that particular verse that they were asking basically this question: is the Lord among us or not? Because if the Lord is among us, why is it, as you might suppose they would think, why is it that we're continually going from one place of being thirsty to another place of being thirsty? That every time we turn around, something miraculous is having to be done just for us to have something to drink. Is the Lord among us or not? Is He with us all the time or is He leaving? Is He going on journeys? Is He forgetting about us and just coming back when we have an emergency? Or is He among us all the time or not? And Israel needs a very important lesson this time. How do you know that God is among you? And when is it actually that God is for you and on your side? Because it cannot just be understood that at all times and every time, God is always doing what you want Him to do and always delivering you from every trouble and always going to be there to tell you that everything is okay. It's not so much about God's willingness as much as it is about your faith. And that's what Israel is having to learn when we come to this name. But what happens next in the next several verses is that they come upon the Amalekites. The Amalekites in verse 8 of Exodus 17. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. The Amalekites were descendants of Esau. You can see that in Genesis 36 and verse 12. And one of the things that you know about Jacob and Esau, that there was a division among them, though it seemed to be at peace at certain stages of their lives. But we also know that throughout the history that these Amalekites seem to hold this continual grudge against the people of God that lasted throughout the generations. In Genesis 27 and verse 41, if you'll look there real quick, Genesis 27 and verse 41, it says, "So Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, 'The days of mourning for my father are at hand, then I will kill my brother Jacob.' that grudge that started there at that particular time that seemed to be smoothed over from time to time as well was something that seemed to last throughout those descendants. That Jacob and the children that Jacob had seemed to have all this blessing and all this encouragement and all this protection from God, and Esau's descendants did not. And the Amalekites, it seemed, did not like that. And so they are the first ones to attack Israel when they're coming out of Egyptian bondage. But you see that they don't form themselves up into a battle array and challenge the people of God to an open field battle and fight. Instead, they start to attack the stragglers and those who are on the edges, those who are weak, those who are tired, and they start to pick them off one at a time. Much the same way that Satan does. He's like a roaring lion, always seeking whom he may devour. And the easiest one to devour is always the one that's on the edges and on the fringe, and so they're always the first to go. But also think about that this was something that lasted well out into the future. You remember in Esther, that in the book of Esther, there's this man named Haman. He's an Agagite, which seems to be, and most scholars believe, that he was a descendant of Agag, the Amalekite. The one that King Saul was supposed to kill, but kept him alive and didn't destroy all the Amalekites as God had demanded. And you remember that in Esther, that Haman had devised a plan to where not only was he going to get to this guy who would not show him respect, but he was going to wipe out all of the Jews. He was going to kill all of them. And so this hatred among those people of Esau, these Amalekites and the people of God, lasted throughout the generations. And it was one that caused them to always be fighting against one another as they left Egyptian bondage, as we see here. And in Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16, you see that. So Moses says to Joshua in verse 9 of Exodus 17, "Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy. Moses is about 80 years old or so at this time. I don't want to hold my hand up for very long, much less if I was his age. So Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this." Here's that word, record. "Write this for a memorial in the book and recount. Recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." These people became such a bane to the people of God that they were a constant menace to not just their national life, but their spiritual well-being as well. So much so that God says, "I want you to write this down, because I don't want you to forget it. I don't want it to just be by word of mouth. I want you to write this down. And I want you to tell it, recount it to Joshua." It's not supposed to just stay with Moses. It doesn't die with Moses. Write it down. Make sure Joshua hears it. Make sure he reads it and make sure he hears it, so that it might be remembered that I am going to do something. It needs to be written, because it may not be in the life of Moses, it may not be in the life of Joshua, but the day is coming, God says, "Well, I will visit this upon the head of the Amalekites, because this is not right." And God was angered by it. That's why God wanted them destroyed. And not just destroyed in small measure, utterly destroyed. This grudge that had happened way back at Esau, that was carried out through these other children, that extended way out into the history in the book of Esther. And then by the time of King Saul, the Amalekites are still those types of people. And they do not destroy them completely, but keep some of the best possessions and Agag and all those types of things that go on. Then Saul himself is later killed by somebody who claims to be an Amalekite. That these people were a constant nuisance to the people of God. Kind of the same way that Satan is. A constant nuisance to the people of God. And God has let it be known, let it be written, let it be recounted, and let it be remembered. I will crush them. The same way the Scriptures tell us that God is going to crush Satan under your feet. Because God takes these things personally. And so it's on this occasion in Exodus chapter 17 and verse 14 that Moses, after he tells that in verse 14, verse 15, and Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner, Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Moses built an altar. He built a place of worship. He built a place of remembrance. He built a place so that people could look upon it and know that this is the place where God said that he would be the banner for his people from generation to generation. But it was symbolic that God was the one who was doing the battle, because as the people looked upon Moses, they had to understand, just as Moses was letting them know, it was not because his hands were raised that they were winning. There was nothing magical about that. But when the people saw Moses' hands raised, it was as if there was a banner being raised. Rally. Move together. Fight. And the people would fight. But when his hands went down, it's because their leader was weak, and so they became weak. But it was only when God was the one who was actually being exalted that they win the battles that they are fighting. And so this name is a very significant one. It's the only time that it's used in the Scriptures is in this particular passage. But it's found this principle throughout the Scriptures. Jehovah, from the idea that we've looked at several times before, that he is the self-existent one. And Nissi, which means a banner or standard. The word itself, Nissi, is translated many times as pole or ensign or standard. It doesn't necessarily mean something with a flag on it. Often in this particular time, especially, it was used for a pole with something that would reflect sunlight on the top. You remember the brazen serpent that was put on a pole. That was a banner. It was a standard. It was an ensign. The word that we use today, standard, has that same derivation attached to it. Even when we use, what is the standard that you are using to measure something by? In other words, where is the place that you rally to? What is the standard or the idea or the principles that you run to whenever you're trying to measure something? What do you use? That's the idea. And so God says that we are to be that rallying point for him. Among the Jews, it was also one of those things that had the idea of miracle attached to it, which makes sense, because that banner that was put up when the people complained and murmured against God, and God sent the serpents among them and bit some of them, and he said, if you want to be cured from this, you have to look to this banner, this standard, this ensign, this brazen serpent on top of the pole, this thing that would reflect what it was that God was offering. And that was miraculous to them, because that's what God does. God provides for the things that we cannot. Moses' hands did not mean anything. There was nothing magical about that. But the only thing that made it special was because God was actually the banner. Often when we talk about things like salvation, people say, well, there's nothing magical about the water. Amen. There's nothing magical about that. There's nothing magical about being immersed in water. There's nothing about that actual act that actually takes away the sins other than this. It is looking to God as the banner. It is looking to God as the standard. It is looking to God as the deliverer. And this is what God says you must look to. This is my banner. This is my standard when it comes to salvation. That's why we use such phrases as that, about things being scriptural, about things being within the confines of the Word and not going beyond and not falling short. It's always about looking to our God for that salvation that He offers. Also, mostly though, this word was used to describe a rallying point, especially in times of invasion. They didn't have the same sort of communication skills that we do with the radios and things such as that, obviously. And so often these banners, these standards would be placed upon a high hill. And if you saw that that banner was there, you knew that there was an invasion in process, and you were to rally to that point. It may not be you that's in trouble, but you know that your people are in trouble. You know that your nation is in trouble, and you know that your brethren, your countrymen, need you. Get here quickly and get ready for the fight. God says, rally to me. Because there is a fight going on, and you need to come here quickly and get ready for battle, because there's an invasion in process. And that's what Satan does. And that's why the Lord is supposed to be our banner. So the Lord is my banner. In Psalm 60 and verse 4, I want to think about some of the ways in which we should think about God being that banner. In Psalm 60 and verse 4, it says, "You have given a banner to those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of truth, that your beloved may be delivered. Save with your right hand and hear me." One of the things that you'll also see often associated with this idea of something being a banner or this idea of being a standard is that prayer is so often associated with it. You notice that Moses was lifting up his hands. Some commentators believe, and we don't know this for certain, but some commentators believe that that's supposed to be symbolic of lifting up holy hands toward our banner, toward our God in prayer. But it is interesting that many times when this word is used, prayer is associated with it. Because when we're rallying to our God, we're rallying there so that He might know we're behind you and we know that you are with us. Lead us in this battle. There's other passages as well, and I want us to go back to Psalm 18. I had Greg stop at verse 6 on purpose because there's a transition that happens between 6 and 7 that I think is so very terrifying in one sense, but incredibly encouraging in another. In those first few verses, to remember what was said, in Psalm 18, verse 1, "I will love you." And then he starts talking about God as being his rock, his fortress, his deliverer, his strength, the one that he trusts in, his shield, his horn of salvation, his stronghold. "And because of all those things, I will call upon the Lord." Now, he's not just saying, "I will call upon the Lord because you are all those things," but he's saying in the next verse, "It's because these pangs of death and the floods of ungodliness have surrounded me. The sorrows of the grave itself are upon me," he says in verses 5 and 6. And so it's in his distress, he's talking about crying out to God. When we are crying out to God in the midst of those types of problems, those types of situations, those types of circumstances, it can feel like we are dying and we don't know what to do. But we do know one who does know what to do. And we do know one that does not waver. And we know one that is not shaken by any of those circumstances. And He is, again, the rock. He is the fortress. He is the deliverer. He is the strength. He is the one that we can trust. He is the horn of my salvation. He is the stronghold. And so I will call upon the Lord. "Thus shall I be saved from my enemies." But notice that when you cry out to God, it's not an empty cry, where you hope that God just listens to you and hears what it is that you say. This is how God reacts when you are in those situations, when you're in the midst of those types of problems and circumstances. This is how God reacts when you cry out to Him. "My cry," the end of verse 6, "came before Him, even to His ears. Then the earth shook and trembled. The foundations of the hills also quaked and were shaken because He was angry. Smoke went from His nostrils and devouring fire from His mouth. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down with darkness under His feet. And He rode upon a cherub and flew. He flew upon the wings of the wind." He didn't delay, in other words. He was quick about it. "He made darkness His secret place. His canopy around Him was dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. From the brightness before Him, His thick cloud passed with hailstone and coals of fire. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered His voice, hailstone and coals of fire. He sent out His arrows and scattered the foe, lightnings in abundance, and He vanquished them. Then the channels of the sea were seen. The foundations of the world were uncovered. At Your rebuke, O Lord, and at the blast of the breath of Your nostrils. He sent from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He also brought me out into a broad place. He delivered me because He delighted in me. The Lord God, Jehovah, is our Nisi. He is our banner. He is our rallying point. God says, come to me. I am your strength. I am your fortress. I am your support. I am your stronghold. I am your banner. And when you cry out to me, and when you come to me because people are attacking you, when they're looking at you and seeing you on the fringe, seeing you weak, seeing you tired, seeing you beat down, know that you're going through all sorts of things, and then one more thing is laid upon you. And Satan does that to you, God says, I become angry because I am your banner. You find your support, you find your strength, you find your safety and security underneath my wings. You are my child, and no one treats my children that way. And that's why God wanted the Amalekites completely destroyed. And that's why this name is recorded in the Scriptures, brethren, so that we might have strong confidence that when we cry out to our God, brethren, our God hears. And our God becomes angry. And He will shake the foundation of the earth. He will destroy this world one day in fire. And it is a right thing with God, he says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, to repay with tribulation, to punish those, eternally punish those who cause you trouble. Because they do not believe in Him and they do not obey the gospel. That is that same eternal punishment that God said He was going to visit. Write it down. Recount it to one another. And remember it. Because God does not forget. That's Jehovah Nissi. That is the Lord God, our banner. That is our strong support. In Jeremiah 20 and verse 11, I love the way that the ESV puts this. The ESV says, "But the Lord is with me as a dread warrior." The New King James, I believe, uses an awesome person or an awesome individual along those lines. It does have that meaning, but I like this term a lot better. A dread warrior. This is the kind of warrior you don't want to meet in battle. This is the kind of person you don't want to run into in a dark alley. Put it that way. And that's who it says our God is for us. We want peace with other people. And the reason that we want peace with other people is because, friend, you don't want to meet Jehovah Nissi being on the wrong side. Let's reconcile this between us, because neither of us want to see and meet this dread warrior, because that's who He is. He is the banner. In Psalm 20, in verses 5 through 8, Psalm 20, verses 5 through 8, here it says, "We will rejoice in your salvation, in the name of our God, who will set up our banners. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions." Now I know that the Lord saves His anointed. Here He's talking about the King of God's people. "He will save His anointed. He will answer him from His holy heaven with the saving strength of His right hand." But notice that He says that God will deliver him. And so He reminds people, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. We glory in that. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stand upright. Because we don't trust in those things. We trust in the Lord who is in our banner. We can also understand, and I think it's very clear from several of the analogies we use, that Christ is also presented as that banner. Even in the Old Testament, the books of prophecy in Isaiah 11 and verse 12, it says that God will set up a banner for the nations. And He will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And we know that what He's talking about is not just the ones who are dispersed from Babylonian captivity, but this prophecy has far-reaching implications as well. That when it comes to our Christ, we know that He talks about from the four corners of the earth, He's gathering together the true children of God. Jesus Himself even said in John chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, "And as Moses lifted up that serpent, that banner in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that whoever believes in Him should not perish but have eternal life." Jesus Christ was lifted up on a pole, as it were, on a stick, as it were. He was put on a mountain that we talked about. And He was placed there for all the world to see. That is my rallying point. That is the place of refuge. That is the place of deliverance. That is the place of strength. I can have my stronghold there because Jesus Christ died on that cross, but He was not eternally dead. He rose from the grave once again. But we know what that cross represents. That represents God's deliverance, and we know that we can run to it. We also know in John 12 and verse 32, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself." Jesus says, "I am the rallying point for all of mankind." So we are to rally around Him. There's a lot of different passages that show different ways in which we do that. One is in Colossians chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. Paul begins his letter to the brethren in Colossae. And after he talks about the prayer that he makes for them, he says, it's for this reason, verse 9, we also, since the day we heard of it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. But notice that everything that Paul is talking about is about being fully pleasing to Him, bearing fruit for Him, being knowledgeable of Him and His spiritual nature. Paul is saying that our manner of life is to be rallied behind that cause. What is it that will make my life fully pleasing to Jehovah Nissi? Because He is my banner. He is my standard. And I don't deviate from that. So it's not pleasing, it's fully pleasing. It's not doing some things for Him, but it's being fruitful for Him. That's our cause. And that's the thing that we have rallied behind in our obedience to the gospel. It's in our love for one another. Jesus said in John 13, verses 34 and 35, that there's a new commandment that I give to you. And that new commandment is this, that the world is going to know that you are mine. By what? By what you've rallied behind. You've rallied behind my cause. Therefore, love one another. And the Scriptures make it clear over and over again, love one another the way that I have loved you, with a sacrificial kind of love, the kind of love that put me on that cross, the kind of love that made me that banner. And you've rallied behind that cause. And so we set aside whatever it is that causes us to not have that love, that purposeful goodwill toward each other. Jesus said that that's the thing that you rally behind in our striving for unity. We talked about this in our Bible class this morning, the meekness and the humility and the endeavoring and the setting aside of different things that we might have the kind of unity that the Bible describes. Never sacrificing the standard that God has given to us, but knowing that that standard is going to draw people from all over the world and all different nations and all different backgrounds and all different tendencies and habits and curiosities and all sorts of things. And that's not the thing that should cause us to not want to go to war together. It's the thing that should make us want to fight more vigorously for one another. Because Jesus Christ is our banner. He is our standard. So put up with each other, he says in Ephesians 4, and keep that bond that we're supposed to have. And it's definitely in our warfare. And understand this before we bring the lesson to a conclusion. There are no bystanders in this warfare. There are no bystanders in this fight. During the Civil War, I'm told, there were places where the battle skirmishes would break out. And some of the more well-to-do, the rich, would often ride in their carriages out to the battlefield and pack a lunch, so that they might have a picnic as they watch the battles. How often is that the case among brethren? I'm going to pack a lunch and watch this. This is going to be entertaining. Jesus Christ is the banner that's been unfurled, as we sang a few moments ago, so that the world might see. And Jesus calls all to rally behind Him. Because in this battle we are either for the Lord or we are against Him. And there are no bystanders. If you're not for me, you are against me, Jesus says. And so we're told in passages such as 2 Corinthians 10, verses 4 through 6, that since it is the Lord's battle, we don't use carnal weapons. We cast down strongholds. We pull down everything that exalts itself against Christ because He's the standard. And we bring every thought into captivity to the obedience. And the way that we do that is not with carnal weapons. I don't do it by forcing you, but I do it by compelling you. I don't do it by putting you through emotional or physical struggles and heartaches. But I do it by pricking your heart. And there's a huge difference. Because just as it was that there was nothing magical about Moses lifting his hand, there's nothing magical about you or I using words with one another. Except for this, they come from our standard bearer. They come from Jehovah Nissi. and they are His words. And it's His battle. And so Ephesians chapter 6 tells us to take upon ourselves the whole armor of who? God. And no less than four times does it say that if you do this, you will be able to stand. Because it's not your armor. It's God's. It's not your standard. It's Jehovah Nissi. It is the Lord who is our standard. It's not the Lord who gave us a standard. It is the Lord who is our standard. And Jesus showed that by His words and His actions. Jesus was a man who went about doing good. He said a lot of things as well, but He was also someone who went about doing good. He was somebody who suffered at the hands of evildoers, yet He didn't revile back in return. And so it wasn't just His words that He said, but it was also His manner of life that He lived. And we learn from our standard bearer, our Jehovah Nissi, who is our Savior. And so who is it who is your banner? What is it that you guide your life by? What is it that you measure things by? What is it that when you look to it, you say that that is the cause that I'm going to rally behind? When you hear that Jesus Christ loved you so much, that He saw you as someone that Satan had attacked because you were weak, He was mightier than you, and you were tired and beat down. And instead of Him having any type of compassion and mercy upon you, He laid burden after burden after burden upon you and your soul. And Jesus Christ said, "I am angry. That is my child, and I want them for myself." That He went to the cross that He might be lifted up, that you might have that thing that you could not do for yourself. Rally behind that. Rally behind it and let that be the standard for your life. If you're subject to the invitation, if we can help you in any way, please come as together we stand and sing.